Sustaining member, for $15 or more a month, you'll receive our fabulous extensive women's history collection and our tote bag. Please go to women.wbai.org, women.wbai.org, to become a WBAI buddy in the name of your favorite program or in the name of all WBAI programs. Or please call 212-209-2950. Do it now. Call 212-209-2950 and say, yes, I want to become a WBAI buddy this Women's History Day.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now, even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now, the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you'll even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You start off each day with a song. You've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft. Little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You start off each day with a song.
Well, Mr. Durante starts the day off with a song. I'm going to start it off with a poem. I did that last week, and I loved the E. Cummings, and I liked the feeling of reading a poem to start the day. Poetry is, maybe it's, I'm reflecting on me, it's a young person's indulgence or means of communicating. I read lots of poetry when I was young. I rarely do now, but occasionally I go back to the poems that had such an impact on me when I was younger. And they provide solace and insight and remind me of the beauty that can exist, how people can weave words Keats, John Keats's poetry just stuns me, as does Emily Dickinson's. I, by the way, am David Rothenberg. The name of the program is, what is the program? It's Any Saturday. And we're on listener sponsor WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. The poem that I'm going to read to you now is by Dylan Thomas. And I remember the sense of great irony which I felt when I first discovered this poem. It reads as following. I'm not a great reader of poetry, but indulge me, please, because I love reading it aloud. Dylan writes, in my craft or solenard exercised in the still night when only the moon rages and the lovers lie abed with all their griefs in their arms, I labor by singing light, not for ambition or bread or the strut and trade of charms on the ivory stages, but for the common wages of their most secret heart. Not for the proud man apart from the raging moon, I write on these spindrift pages, not for the towering dead with their nightingale and psalms, but for the lovers, their arms round the griefs of the ages, who pay no praise or wages, nor heed my craft or art. Ironic and beautiful. Dylan Thomas. Well, that's the beauty that exists in the world. Let's look at real life. Well, St. Peter's won last night. That was exciting. Jersey City must be ecstatic. 15th seed in the NCAA, and they've gone to the final eight. They play somebody tomorrow. I don't know. I guess it's whoever won between North Carolina and UCLA. Don't know. But even if they don't go any further, what excitement they brought to that little hamlet, that small city in New Jersey. Just a bunch of kids. The second smallest school, their enrollment is infinitesimal compared to the large universities that can lure top athletes. So that's kind of exciting. The city has a new dividing spot. Mayor Adams, pressured, I suspect, by the Yankees. The Yankees owners have a lot of power, and he couldn't excuse Aaron Judge, who's disappointed me greatly by not being who I gather is not a vaccinated man. And he couldn't excuse the Yankees and the Mets without letting Tyree Irving play for the Nets. But not the sanitation workers or the cops or the correction officers who haven't been vaccinated. So that's a class split. And Eric Adams will hear about this for a long time because it's a capitulation to the power brokers. It may make some of the fans happy that Tyree Irving is going to be playing in the NBA playoffs and that Aaron Judge will be there on opening day. But there's something, as a lifelong sports fan, lover, I mean, what did I do last night? I watched St. Peter's, and then I watched the Knicks. The Knicks beat Miami, and young IQ, who I think is the future of the Knicks, scored a major upset over Miami. So all of that is happening. And then today in the Times, the people are, I don't know who they are, but they're asking for Ginny, because of Ginny Thomas, for Clarence, her husband, the Supreme Court Justice, to recuse himself on all January 6 cases. I have a better idea. Why doesn't Clarence Thomas just resign? He's gotten out of the hospital. He's 73. They don't indicate, they said flu-like symptoms. It sounds like COVID to me, but who knows? Maybe he should take care of his health. And someone, when I was lamenting about Clarence Thomas, they said, get one good reason why you should resign. And I said, because I loathe him. I can't think of a better reason. I can't stand Clarence Thomas or his little bride, Jenny. And I think he should recuse himself. And Joe Biden would have a choice of people. As I've said, my first choice for the Supreme Court Judge Jackson was nominated. My first choice was not a black female, but a black man, Barack Obama. My second choice was another black man, Brian Stevenson. My first woman of choice was Anita Hill, because I love the idea of her being on the Supreme Court with Clarence Thomas. But Senator Jackson, we'll talk about that. Judge Jackson, we'll talk about that a little later. I would be very happy if Clarence Thomas resigned. I think he should. I think his wife has compromised not only on the January 6th, which is several cases might well come to the Supreme Court and have already. She has sprinkled herself over the terrain, and I think that makes him a compromised figure. I think he should recuse himself from everything, and maybe rather than just not participate in specific, make us all very happy and resign. The fact that he inherited Thurgood Marshall's seat is unto itself an assault on one's sensibilities. So there you go. We're listener sponsored. Have I mentioned that lately? In the last 40 or 50 years since I've been on the air with you, I get theater tickets. Now, I have a couple of shows that we have for tomorrow, and I usually don't take the offer of tickets for the Sunday following the Saturday program, because it's I have to make sure I'll get the names to the that the box office will get it. But I've done all of that for these two shows, and because these are the only dates offered so far, and I can't not take advantage of it for the listeners. So I want to tell you that tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, we have 5 pair of tickets for David Mamet's On Broadway revival of American Buffalo, with Lawrence Fishburne and Academy Award winner Sam Rockwell in the cast. I am an aficionado of this play. I saw the original production. I think Robert Duvall was in it. And then the revival with Al Pacino at the Circle in the Square downtown. And why I became and how I became an expert is that when Pacino was doing it, they didn't play Sunday night, and they were off all day Monday, and he had that 2-day lapse, and he told the general manager and the stage manager that he wanted to do a run-through on Tuesday afternoons before he resumed playing on Tuesday night. So on every Tuesday afternoon, they did a run-through of the play, and he wanted an audience there, and they could come. And the company manager was a friend of mine and knew of the Fortune Society. And so every Tuesday at 2 o'clock, I think it was, I would come with about 20 or 25 men and women from the Fortune Society to see Al Pacino in American Buffalo. There were always 2 or 3 other nonprofit groups there, people who obviously didn't have the bucks to pay to see a Pacino production, but had desire to see it. So I saw American Buffalo about 12 or 13 Tuesdays in a row, escorting the men and women from Fortune. And I was able to study the brilliance of Pacino and the subtlety of David Mamet. Mamet's a provocative man unto himself. And 2 of his plays, I think, are outstanding. One is American Buffalo, and the other is Glengarry Glen Ross. Here's that one actor that I, the 2 character play, the man and the teacher and the student. When I first saw his work at the Orpheum, can't remember the title, but somebody will tell me. And that was quite good also. But Mamet's an important figure in American theater history. So we have 5 pair of tickets for American Buffalo at Circle in the Square on 51st Street tomorrow. $60 comes to BAI. Most of you theater goers who listen on Saturday morning know the drill. You email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Give your phone number and I'll call you today. And because we only have 5 pair, and because it is American Buffalo and it is David Mamet and Lawrence Fishburne and Sam Rockwell, the first 5 by the time, you know, when you get a thing on your computer, it gives you the times. So the first 5 by time will be the 5 that get it for tomorrow night. I don't know if people want to go to the theater at 7 o'clock on a Sunday night. I don't know if this is enough time. I do know that Lawrence Fishburne and Sam Rockwell in a play by David Mamet coming to Broadway is, if you like the theater, then you like You'd have to go for this, right? I can't imagine not. So on your mark, get set, go. dprfortune@hotmail.com. Give your phone number, give your address, it'll make my life a little easier. And Johnny Mathis, whose voice brings serenity to my life, one of his great hits, written by, and you know, and they don't tell you first names and CDs and records anymore. They never did, probably. Stillman and Allen wrote this song. Here's Johnny Mathis with Chances Are.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin the moment you come into view. Chances are you think that I'm in love with you. Just because my composure sort of slips the moment that your lips meet mine. Chances are you think my heart's your valentine. In the magic of moonlight, when I sigh, hold me close, dear. Chances are for me, and if you think you could, well, chances are your chances are awfully good.
Feel better already just listening to Johnny Mathis. I remember years ago, my friend, years ago, how many times have you said that lately? I think there was a play by Ruth Gordon called Years Ago, and I didn't quite understand the significance of that until I found that half my conversations began with years ago. My friend and colleague, Ruth Cage, was working at a music tent in Connecticut somewhere, and Johnny Mathis was the featured performer. And she and Johnny were having post-dinner theater and drinks, and she said, let's call my friend David Rothenberg. He loves your music. And so at midnight, I get a phone call, Ruth Cage, somebody wants to say hello to you. Hi, David, Johnny Mathis here. And yeah, I said. And we talked at length, and I told them of how much I enjoyed his music. I was about 26 at the time. And just to think in the middle of the night to get a phone call from Johnny Mathis, and Ruth and Johnny said, oh, when we come into the city, we'll have dinner with you. It never happened, but I do have the memory of a middle of the night, was a middle of the night phone call for me to hear from Johnny Mathis. Well, one of the big stories this week was obviously with the hearings, Judge Jackson. I watched a little bit of it. I couldn't after a while. Somebody said, what is your reaction? I said, I guess the word is that it's an embarrassment to our country to hear this woman. I didn't know who she was before, but she clearly is a lettered judge he wouldn't have nominated if she didn't have the credentials, and we heard it, and she seems to have everything in place to be a judge at that level. She has moved up the ladder, and I read that as she moved up the ladder, always had Republican support, and now it's political. And I think the embarrassment was the level of discourse or questioning by some of the Republicans. Josh Hawley, that woman from Tennessee, Marsha Blackburn, they should have half the qualities and credentials and qualifications that Judge Jackson has. So I know many of my friends, you might have stayed glued to the TV. I can't anymore. It's embarrassing. That's the only word I can think of. It's an embarrassment to watch our alleged leaders in Washington make such an obviously partisan display of themselves. I guess the same could be said of the Democrats when the Republican candidates for the Supreme Court came, although I didn't find their credentials as impeccable. So that's a matter of preference. I think Amy Baker seems like a nice lady. I'm sure she's would be very good at the PTA. She didn't have nearly. Well, I'm going on and on. You get the picture. Stop. At 8:16, we had five people for or 8:20. I think we had five people for American Buffalo. So you need not. Email me, because I suspect they're all gone. To see Lawrence Fishburne and American Buffalo. Now, I told you that there was a second show that we have for Sunday, and you might not have heard of it. I barely did. It started during the pre-pandemic, was canceled because of the pandemic, and resumed. And there was something about it that made me want to go see it at the Cherry Lane Theater. So here's my review of it. And then I'll tell you the tickets that we have for it just for tomorrow. And I'm looking for my... Here's my review. There is nothing more exhilarating for me than to walk into a theater with no preconceived notions or expectations, and then be knocked for a loop by the sheer power that unfolds on stage. Welcome to the venerable off-Broadway Cherry Lane Theater, where Jessica Blank and Eric Jensen's Coal Country is a mesmerizing theatrical powerhouse. Blank and Jensen have created a vivid theatrical docudrama with the same skill they exhibited a decade ago with the prize-winning The Exonerated. That was the thing that got me to want to go see this, because I remembered how brilliant The Exonerated was. Here at the Cherry Lane, they have given dramatic shape to a tragic massacre in West Virginia's coal country. The survivors and loved ones of the 2010 mine explosion in Upper Big Branch have been assembled to reflect and to celebrate their lost partners and to assess the corporate compromises and bottom line shortcuts. Greed is the antagonist in this saga. Coal Country is an artistic cousin to a current documentary film called Downfall, which exposes Boeing's descent into expediency. Coal Country is much more, though, than historic and political inflections. Director Steve Earle has guided an inspired group of actors who reveal the humanity and the ethos of people in West Virginia's coal mining world. They are alive, they're passionate, and they are angry. Mr. Earle and his guitar are, on stage serving as a one-man musical Greek chorus, offering eloquent musical commentary on the simple habits of decent folks amidst corporate indifference and late apologies. At one juncture, the entire company joins Earl in a musical elegy of high voltage, recalling the lost miners and their shattered dreams. Not a dry eye in the house, including mine, when that was done. The entire cast is exceptional, yet I must give particular attention to Mary Bacon, portraying a woman whose simple dignity masks the tears of a lost love, and the robust Ezra Knight, reflecting on his father's record collection, which embraces a lifetime of father and son, love and respect. Cold Country is profound, and it succeeds on many levels, not the least of which that it gives voice and face to an overlooked chunk of Americana. This is theater which cleanses the soul and reverberates far beyond the walls of the cherished 100-year-old Cherry Lane Theater. Let me add that if I were on the Pulitzer Prize committee, I would the criterion for drama and Pulitzer Prize is its reflection of American lore. Cold Country should be a consideration for those who determine the Pulitzer Prize in drama. We have a limited number of tickets for Cold Country at the Cherry Lane tomorrow. We have 2 pair for the matinee at 2 o'clock and 5 pair for the 7 o'clock show. I wish we had more. I wish we could have give you more time. I think the whole world should see, everybody should see this play. We came out of it. I was with 2 friends, and it's so wonderful to come out of the theater, and all you want to talk about is the people that you met. They came to life, and the struggle. And I remember covering the trial, a man named Blankenship, who's alluded to in this play, who was on trial, the company that compromised safety that led, just like Boeing with the planes, that led to this disaster. But as I was saying to my friends, that I knew of the case, but I didn't make the, I followed the trial of Blankenship in West Virginia, but I didn't make the connection, which the play gives you, is that the people that survived it, some of the miners that survived it and their families that live with it in this state, which goes Republican all now, they didn't used to. I don't know why the Democrats haven't reached them to let them know that their struggle is not Trump's struggle, or Manson, who seems to be involved in the profits of West Virginia. Anyway, Cold Country, and I will go by the times that you all have send in the email, dprfortune@hotmail.com. Give your phone number, and your address would make it easier for me when I call you. $60 goes to BAI. You get 2 tickets. And the Cherry Lane Theater, have you been down there lately? I worked on so many shows when I worked with Richard Barr and Edward Albee and Clinton Wilder. We did so many shows at the Cherry Lane Theater. And that little curve on Commerce Street, it looks like the set in a play. I've always said, when you go there, if you go there, and you should, whether you get tickets via me or and BAI or on your own initiative, that charming street, it's 1920s, there's a plaque there about Edna. No, is that where the plaque of Edna St.? No, that's where the plaque about Kim Stanley is. There might be a plaque there about Edna St. Yeah, I think Edna St. Vincent Millay started the theater, was part of the opening of the theater 100 years ago. And you feel you could be there. You might wait for a horseless carriage to go by. And I always thought that if it looks like the set of a play or a movie, and at the turntable, and suddenly you could be on a ship going into the harbor. It's just beautiful. It's Americana at its richest and best. And anyway, coal country. And needless to say, I was moved beyond belief in seeing it. So email me. Well, I see the computer thing is lit up, so I guess you are responding to my enthusiasm. From the Broadway musical, Two on the Isle, Jules Stein wrote the music, Comden and Green wrote the lyrics, Burt Law starred in it, and he had a young woman who made her, this was a Broadway starring role, her name was Dolores Gray, and she had a big merman-like voice. She did some movies, she starred on Broadway somewhat, but well, just listen, this is what Comden and Green's lyrics, it's just wonderful. You may be a little impatient at the beginning because she builds up, but here's Dolores Gray with If.
Heart. I really don't know what to do about him. I've told myself I've got to do without him. There he goes, as usual, my man, tearing my heart apart. He's made my life a mess. I've got to do this, I guess. Goodbye, Joe. From here I kiss you. Goodbye, Joe. I hope I don't miss you. Been on the square and had treated me fair, we'd have not had a tiff. If you had not said I should go and jump right off the nearest cliff. If you had stayed off the make and you just hadn't taken to coming home stiff. If I had not spelled fume with a nasty unfamiliar whiff. I'm gonna miss you, baby. Things could have been terrific. Ah, what's the diff? If you had not had the cheek to stay out for a week saying back in a jiff. If you were not such a two-timing guy. If you weren't, if you hadn't, if you didn't, if you worried, if you hadn't, if you didn't, but you have and you were and you went and you need him, so goodbye. If I had not seen you take Geraldine on the lake in your flat-bottomed skiff. If you were not found to sue with your arms around her bare midriff. If I had not seen you pen sexy letters to Gwen in your own hieroglyph. If you had not left me home when you had two seats for South Pacific. I'm gonna miss you, baby. You were too dumb. If you were not such a hound who, when game was around, always picked up the sniff. If you were not such a two-timing guy. If you weren't, if you hadn't, if you didn't, if you weren't, if you hadn't, if you didn't, but you have and you were and you went and you did, and so goodbye. If when I asked where you'd been, you would not clip my chin with a beautiful biff. If I had not always found purple lipstick on your handkerchief. If you had not told me lies and then looked in my eyes with a smile, be a tiff. If, when I caught you with Kate, you had not said, it's of no signif. I'm gonna miss you, baby. And I could get specific. Ah, what's the diff? If the best years of my life weren't spent as your wife with no married certif. If you were not such a two-timing guy. If you weren't. If you hadn't. If you didn't, if you weren't, if you hadn't, if you didn't, but you have and you were and you went and you did, and so goodbye.
Dolores Gray, she could belt it out, couldn't she? You know, by the way, talking about the Cherry Lane Theater, which I was, it's an intimate, wonderful, it's a jewel box of a theater. And I remember, it's the theater where I first saw B. Arthur in an off-Broadway musical by Sheldon Harnick. And when she sang, I said, the black back wall is going to cave in because her voice was so big. And she went, I think she had a good career after that. Out on a Limb, I do an essay every week about this time, and you're about to hear it now. We're in a time of great uncertainty. The future has always been embedded with surprises, but for those of us who have more days lived than days that await us, there have always been predictable outcomes. I never recall a time with such an accumulation of uncertainties. A war being choreographed by a tyrant, apparently impervious of the implications, not only to the carnage being inflicted on the Ukraine, but how the rest of the world is restless, cautious, uncertain, fearful of it being a starting juncture for a world war. And for what? At the same time, we're told that there's a possible third COVID wave with no clarity of the scope or depth of the new variant, leaving a new generation growing up masked, separated from their peers, and zoomed to the gills. And then there's the ugliness of Trumpism lingering, and we wonder if it's a passing fascist phase like McCarthyism or bad shrimp, or is it what America opts for? So if we survive Putin's war and the new variant fades away, taking Trump along with it, we're left confronting climate change, which could alter the choices of where people live, bringing with it hurricanes and tsunamis and tornadoes and fires and drafts. A Cecil B. DeMille biblical spectacle for the 21st century. Modern technology and science have become front and center, a factor in Putin's weapon availability, vaccines that could eradicate COVID, internet communications that spread Trump-inspired fears and falsehoods, and the ability to combat the changing globe with alternatives to fossil fuels, which continue to damage the planet. I hope I haven't depressed you so far. Uncertainties, to say the least. I've slowly come to recognize the conspiracy that limits education, titans of industry, oligarchs need political control to sustain their singular economic pursuits. And information or an enlightened public is not only a threat, but their enemy. For example, Putin, one of the world's richest men, is inexplicably attempting to devour the Ukraine, an example of one who has achieved authority through bombast rather than acumen. We're witness to the decimation of a country, a slaughter of its citizens. And how many have we seen in our lives, similarly scarred? Syria, Rwanda, Vietnam, all as a result of unclear thinking, motivated by avarice, resentment, suspicion, fears, real and unfounded, and ignorant of history. To this day, I have no idea why we were in Vietnam, where we were responsible for thousands of deaths, Vietnamese and American GIs. We ravaged towns and set fire to their land. How many of those young men returned here, some without limbs or eyes, and they were told that they had been preserving our way of life, when in fact their very presence in Vietnam was an assault, a contradiction on the reasons for America being. Many returned addicted. They were veterans with emotional scars, and they created a disorganized army of homeless people. Others filled our jails and prisons, their experience in Vietnam having taught them more about guns than the principles of democracy. There's nothing new about Putin's Napoleonic behavior, save for the fact that the modernization of weapons could annihilate the planet before climate change intrusions could accelerate the process. It's chilling to realize that the vox populi is cognizant and accepting of great technological advances, from TikTok to Facebook to gas warfare and nuclear bombs. But millions still resist a vaccine that could put a halt to the latest virus, which has already been the cause of 6 million deaths worldwide and nearly a million to the league leading United States. Wearing or not wearing a mask has become a political issue as much as the manufacture and possession of weapons that could wipe out a battalion. I've reached the conclusion that the mask refuseniks didn't have a mother or grandmother warning them, cover your mouth, young man, when you cough or sneeze. See that you don't spread your germs around. I wonder if the non-mask wearers and vaccination abstainers crying about their freedom, it's my body. I wonder if they feel that when they stop their car for a red light, that it compromises their concept of democracy or being free. A sound government at its most responsible creates protection guidelines, traffic lights so we don't crash into each other, killing us and them. Vaccination so we can enjoy life, sustain life, which is slightly more important than Tyree Irving playing for the Nets during the playoffs at Barclays Center. Maybe everyone is not uncertain, so absorbed in their smartphones that they can't see the motorbikes crashing through a red light. Perhaps it's just me who is uncertain. I know that the world has always been a challenge. We living in the shadows of a Trumpish America know that he didn't invent evil. Way before Trump became bored being a sleazy businessman and a reality show joke, we had poverty and lynchings and senseless wars, all part of our history. But we also had Cesar Chavez and Eleanor Roosevelt, Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, Harvey Milk and Stephen Sondheim, Willie Mays and Jerry Miller, Barack Obama and Bryan Stevenson, Julie Harris, Emily Dickinson, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Bayard Rustin, and many others who guided to celebrate America so we know what we can be and we can resist those that threaten us, like the January 6th marauders attempted to do in Trump's name. And I suspect that there were unknown young people whose names have not yet attracted the lights, who are doing wonderful and creative things that can be will be added to the list that includes Martin Luther King and Eleanor Roosevelt. I'm certain of one thing, and that is that I am uncertain of what my country wants to be. Do the words of Edmund Burke even resonate today? All that's needed for the forces of evil to succeed is for enough good people to remain silent. I'm David Rothenberg, out on a limb. And here's Rex Harrison with a change of mood from My Fair Lady by Lerner and Lowe.
Look at her, a prisoner of the gutter, condemned by every syllable she utters. By right, she should be taken out and hung for the cold-blooded murder of the English tongue.
Ow!
Ow! Heavens, what a noise! This is what the British population calls an elementary education.
Oh, come, sir, I think you picked a poor example.
Did I? Hear them down in Soho Square, dropping H's everywhere, speaking English any way they like. You, sir, did you go to school?
What do you take me for, a fool?
No one taught him take instead of type. Hear a Yorkshireman, or worse, hear a Cornishman converse. I'd rather hear a choir singing flat. Chickens cackling in a barn, just like this one.
Gom.
Gom. I ask you, sir, what sort of word is that? It's ow and gone that keep her in her place. Not her wretched clothes and dirty face. Why can't the English teach their children how to speak? This verbal class distinction by now should be antique. If you spoke as she does, sir, instead of the way you do, why, you might be in selling flowers, too.
I beg your pardon, sir.
An Englishman's way of speaking absolutely classifies him. The moment he talks, he makes some other Englishman despise him. One common language I'm afraid we'll never get. Oh, why can't the English learn to set a good example to people whose English is painful to your ears? The Scotch and the Irish leave you close to tears. There even are places where English completely disappears. In America, they haven't used it for years. Why can't the English teach their children how to speak? Norwegians learn Norwegian, the Greeks are taught their Greek. In France, every Frenchman knows his language from A to Z.
French don't care what they do, actually, as long as they pronounce it properly.
Arabians learn Arabian with the speed of summer lightning, and the Hebrews learn it backwards, which is absolutely frightening. But use proper English, you're regarded as a freak. Oh, why can't the English? Why can't the English learn to speak?
He won a Tony Award and an Academy Award playing Professor Henry Higgins in Lerner and Lowe and Morshart's adaptation of George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, Rex Harrison. A book review. By the way, I haven't been able to decipher all the emails for Cross Country, but according to my computer, it's saturated with requests. I will get back to the first five on American Buffalo and the first seven on Cross Country. Here's a book review in the Arts Corner. Karen Booth, published by Putnam. Karen J. Walker's intriguing historic novel is a challenge and a revelation. The author has located a new perspective on one of the most insidious acts in American history, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. As she informs us in her author notes, this project began with her wonderment about the family of one of the most reviled men in history, John Wilkes Booth. Miss Walker brings the entire Booth clan to life in a colorful and complex brood they were. The parents of 10 children, four of whom died in their infancy, were never married. The surviving offsprings discover that their father, Junius Booth, an accomplished Shakespearean actor, had a second family in England. The boys, Edmund, June, and John Wilkes, all became actors, and Joe became a doctor. Their daughters, Rosalie and Althea, kept diaries, which provided, I suspect, most of the family's dynamics and conflicts, as reported or covered by the author. John Wilkes is not the centerpiece of the book, Booth, but it was his infamous act that has evoked interest in his siblings and parents. Most of the family were Lincoln loyalists, John Wilkes alone sympathetic to the South's slave-owning economy. In addition to killing Lincoln, John Wilkes destroyed his family spirit. The people who loved him most lived with the rippling effects of his dastardly performance. Booth, all of them, resonates well into this century. After I read it, I read a review that was slightly critical in the Times. I found it riveting. If you like historic novels, I think Booth might be appealing to you. At the movies, I read one other book. I thought I'd never finish. I read Thomas Mann's Budden books for the first time, 700 pages. I was so caught up in 19th century Germany, mid-19th century Germany, that when I started reading the next book, which is a John Sanford, I felt that I was reading Dick and Spot and Jane. Because Mann, who was a Nobel winner for his literature, and Buddenbrooks was his first great novel. It was published in 1900. In those days, they had nothing else to do but write long books, and people read, sat and read. Somebody could enter a room, and he could describe their eyelashes for two pages without a comma. And it's not quite Proustian, but it's at points, the saga of four generations of a single family it's almost like a miniseries. But some of the details are ponderous, but I couldn't let go. Buddenbrooks is it's a classic. That's what people told me. And it was absorbing, although I thought I would never finish it. At the movies, I saw The Outfit, which the reason to see it is because Mark Rylance is in it, and he's an extraordinary actor. The movie has more irony than logic, but you won't be bored in it. I also discovered that going to a Cineplex is not as much not as satisfying for serious moviegoers going to the Film Forum or the Angelica or the Quads or the IFC, because there maybe have been four people in the theater at the Cineplex I was at in Chelsea, a couple about 10 rows in front of me who argued through the whole movie, and a man about four rows in front of me, directly in front of me, for some reason, felt it necessary to stand at long intervals. That doesn't happen at indies. I don't think they were serious moviegoers. I saw a picture that's opening Friday at the Film Forum. Phew, it's called Bobby Yar. Here's what the Film Forum says. More than the footage is extraordinary. It's a documentary that is so vivid, taken at the time that the Nazis overtook the Ukraine, which gives it a certain resonance of today, does it not? And it also shows the film footage of when the Russians kicked the Germans out later on. But the fascinating thing is that you see crowds cheering effusively for the Nazis coming in and posting the pictures of Hitler. And then the crowds cheering effusively when the Russians come in and they put up the pictures of Stalin. But where they got this footage, who, and there's no narration. You're just left to figure out who's who. But the grueling extermination of the Jews is so vivid and so painful to watch. And yet it's part of history of the world and has to be seen. Then they show you the trial, the mundacity. You talk about the what Hannah Arendt called about the banality of evil. This young, clean-cut German soldier-looking Robert Redford-ish, giving very calm description of following orders and killing dozens of people. And then you see him and others with the noose put around the neck, and you watch the hangings. Bobby Yar is not for the, I don't know who it's for. It's important footage. I'm glad I saw it. I don't want to see it again. It's opening Friday at the Film Forum. I'm sure it'll get very provocative reviews. It's where the footage come from. Maybe in the reviews, A.O. Scott might tell us. And then I saw a movie from Israel yesterday called Ahmad's Knee, which A.O. Scott liked in the Times. I don't know why. I found it sophomoric and a directorial indulgence. And the Oscars are tomorrow night. And one of the hosts is Wanda Sykes. And we at BAI first knew Wanda Sykes, you know, in the 90s, in 80s and 90s, I produced as fundraisers for this station on Sunday nights, comedy night at Stand Up New York. And I would go to the comedy clubs and get unknown comics to come. One was Lewis Black. I remember a guy named John Stewart came and sat and watched. He didn't make the cut. One of the guys that's on Modern Family was on it, but we did four women, and I went to several producers and said, this is an off-Broadway show, four funny women. And they said, no, you'd have to get Joan Rivers or a big star. And I said, the humor is rich and you could interlace it with different comics. But the four women were Julie Holston, Joy Behar, Sissy Essman, who went into what's the name of the show that I never watched except to see Susie, and Wanda Sykes, who was an unknown comic and very funny. All four women were hysterical. It was a great evening. Wanda Sykes is one of the hosts of the Oscars on Sunday night. And let's play some Martha Davis and Spouse, who I don't know if you remember her. I used to see her. She was sort of the female Fats Waller. And I would see her on Milton Berle's show or Ed Sullivan and thought, that's an interesting woman. And while we're listening to Martha Davis, Sean will be calling Marty Feynman, who was our guest. And we're going to talk about children and the criminal justice system in this city and this state. But in the meantime, let me reintroduce you, if you are of a certain age, or introduce you for the first time, to Martha Davis and Spouse. And her spouse was a musician who she met named Calvin Panda, and she liked his playing the whatever instrument he was playing. So she married him, and here they are, Martha Davison's spouse.
Are you ready for it? So let's get together. Nice round of applause for Martha Davis and her spouse.
The other night, and from what they say, everything turned out all right. The band was in a mellow groove, and all the chicks were on the move. Well, the refreshments were good and everything, and we entertained ourselves as best as we could. Now, Amanda Jones, she was tall and lean, and she took off just like a washing machine. But she forgot she was just about doing her best when she had on a real long dress. And then when she slipped and she fell on her head, we had to pick her up and put her in the bed. She went bippity bippity bop. A bippity bippity bop, a bippity bippity bop, a bop bop. Second verse, a little worse. Now Nellie Lou, she turned up her nose. She said, "I can do that with my eyes closed." So you can catch up on this jive. That's what I'm just about getting ready to put out. Now she says, "Look out, boys. We're gonna do this and that." And then all of a sudden we heard a crack, and poor old Nellie, she fell on her back. So we picked her up, rubbed her with a little alcohol, and put her in a chair, propped her up against the wall. She went bippity bippity bop, a bippity bippity bop, a bippity bippity bop, a bop bop. Third verse, almost like the first. Now Susie Jane, she was fat and sassy. She had too much to drink and her eyes were glassy. She stumbled out and she started to fake, and then she did a pretty good job of doing the shake. Well, she went over the top and did a buck and wing, and she did the Highland Fling and the Lindy Hop and all those things. And just when everybody started hollering for more, poor Susie slipped and fell on the floor. She went bippity bippity bop, a bippity bippity bop, a bippity bippity bop, a bop bop, instrumental solo. Now walk it, look out. Susie Jane walking, look out. Now Sophronia B, she let out a roar. She said, "Lock the windows and lock the door. There ain't a gal around for miles who can put out what I'm getting ready to put out. And I'll bet there ain't a man alive that can pick up on this real mellow jive." That ain't what puzzled me. I wonder just how she picked up on that energy. Well, folks, I'd like to make it clear we had to pull her down from the chandelier. She went bippity bippity bop, a bippity bippity bop, a bippity bippity bop, a bippity bippity bop, a bop bop. One more time. She went bippity bippity bop, a bippity bippity bop, a bippity bippity bop, a bop bop.
Now, that was Martha Davison's spouse. I'm David Rothenberg. The program is any Saturday on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM. Susie Yesman, according to about 14 emails that came in, was on Curb Your Enthusiasm. And Marty Feynman is with us on the phone right now. Good morning.
Good morning, David. How are you?
How are you? We're going to talk about children and criminal justice. You, an attorney, are you officially with the Legal Aid Society or... what is your actual
Well, good question. I've been with the Legal Aid Society for almost 36 years. I actually just recently retired, but I'm staying aboard as a pro bono attorney, sort of a consultant, to work on a number of special projects, one of them having to do with legislation that I helped to draft that is pending in the state Senate and state assembly, having to do with the interrogation of youth under the age of 18.
That's what we want to talk about. I want to talk about that with you and that generally about how we approach children. I know you and I had discussed yesterday Vinnie Schiraldi's editorial in the Daily News of a week ago about trying children as adults because of the nature of their crime. But let's first start with the legislation. Explain what it is and also how people of conscience can contact their legislator to support this. What the essence of the bill concerns what? And I guess it was inspired by the fact that we have become painfully enlightened about the very specifics of the Central Park five exonerated youths.
Yes. And that really, you know, as extraordinary and outrageous and disturbing as that was and other incidents like that. And when I say incidents, I mean the miscarriages of justice where false confessions were obtained from youth and resulted in years spent in prison before exoneration. That's actually only the tip of the iceberg with regards to the underlying issue. The underlying issue has to do with the fact that everybody, as we all know from school and from watching TV and movies, everybody has the right to remain silent. That's guaranteed to us by the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and by the state constitution as well. And the Supreme Court long ago said that for someone to give up their right to remain silent, a waiver of that right to remain silent in response to the Miranda warnings, which the Supreme Court, you know, sort of identified back in, I think, 64, that any waiver has to be a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver. And there has been, over the last 40 years, an extraordinary amount of social science research about the development, adolescent development, the cognitive, emotional, neurological development of youth. And, you know, I'm oversimplifying it dramatically when I say, but not incorrectly, when I say that the result of that research is that we understand that youth under the age of 18 really lack the capacity, the wherewithal, to fully appreciate what that right to remain silent means.
Marty, it's why they can't vote, why they can't drink, because we know all that.
Well, sure. You know, I mean, and those are like significant rights. I mean, kids don't even have the right, if you're in school, you don't have the right to go to the bathroom whenever you want to. You don't have the right to go to bed whenever you want to. You know, that's how much we question their judgment. So the idea that they have the judgment, and let me emphasize, within the context of a custodial interrogation, you know, which is an extraordinary stressful environment, and the nature of that stressful environment is such that it further undermines their capacity to really function, you know, really effectively. So to think that these kids who we don't believe have the judgment to exercise responsibly decisions with regards to those simplest matters, we're saying that nevertheless, well, they do when they're in police custody, you know, have the capacity to understand when a police officer says to them, when they've been placed under arrest, you have this right to remain silent, that they get it, and that they can appreciate the potential long-term consequences of waiving that right to remain silent. It's social science makes it clear that that's absolutely ludicrous. It's a myth. It renders that right meaningless.
Do you remember in the footage of the interviews that we saw, I don't know if it was the Ken Burns movie or one of them, that the boys who were 13 and 14 kept asking, if I talk, can I go home now? It was so naive and so sad, but they were little, they were children.
No, it's terrible. It's just absolutely terrible. And, you know, there are a lot of concerns that I have about the way that the police handle themselves in the context of these interrogations. But let's assume for the fact of the argument that the police don't do anything that they're not entitled to do. Some of the things that they are entitled to do and that they do regularly is they lie to the youth about the evidence that they have, about who they've spoken to, about what they know. They lie in an effort to coerce the waiver of the right to remain silent, and they lie in an effort to get the youth to say what they want. They don't have to allow the youth an opportunity to talk with a parent if the parent is there beforehand. They don't have to inform the youth and the parent, if there is a parent there, what it is that they want to speak to them about before they issue the Miranda warnings and extract a waiver from that youth. There's an enormous amount of things that the police can do that are perfectly legal and that they've been trained to do in an effort to coerce them to waive that right to remain silent and to say what it is that the police want them to say. And we also know from this research that the presence of a parent is really not sufficient protection for a variety of reasons, including sometimes there being a conflict in the interest of the parent and the youth. But even when there isn't a conflict, that even with the most well-intentioned and well-meaning parent, it's not a situation where the parent can provide adequate advice to address this very, very significant legal situation. So what our bill proposes is that it mandates that if the police want to speak to a youth who is in custody, before they can read them the Miranda warnings, before they can get that youth to consider waiving the right to remain silent, the youth must first, and I emphasize the word must, first consult with an attorney who can explain the right to remain silent to the youth, who can explain the repercussions and consequences potentially of waiving that right to remain silent, and who can make sure that if there is going to be a waiver, and in all likelihood, in most cases, after consulting with an attorney, there won't be, but if there is a waiver, we can be assured that it's a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver. And let me just add, David, what makes this all the more upsetting and all the more disturbing is that the impact of this miscarriage of justice as it exists today falls almost exclusively on the shoulders of our youth of color, black and brown youth, who represent a disproportionate majority of the youth who are in the juvenile and criminal justice system, and who also, more often than not, come from backgrounds where they lack the economic capacity to the moment they find out about there being arrest, a parent, to contacting an attorney, to having an attorney that they're familiar with, that they know, that they can retain on their own right out of the gate to say, you know, Johnny's been arrested, please help me out with Johnny, and to make sure that Johnny's interests are absolutely and adequately protected right from the start.
Marty, is New York behind or typical of what you have seen around the country?
You know, it's both, David. It's behind in the sense that California, which is the largest state in the country, has had a law to this effect on the books for 5 years. And that law has worked so effectively that they actually, when they first put it on the books, when it was first passed by the California legislature, it only applied to youth 15 and under, and it had a sunset clause. You know, it was going to exist for several years, and then it would be reconsidered. It would expire unless it was renewed. Well, what they've done since they originally passed it is they have actually extended it to all youth under the age of 18, and they have erased the sunset clause. There is no sunset clause. So it's on the books permanently in California, and it has worked effectively, so effectively that we, in fact, have a letter of support for our legislation in New York from the district attorney of Los Angeles County. District Attorney Gascon has written a letter supporting our bill. The district attorney in San Francisco County, Chesa Boudin, has not written a letter specifically for us, but he has testified in support of that legislation in California. The state of Maryland, the state of rather of Washington, has passed legislation to this effect. There are some other states that have not passed this particular legislation, but have moved in this direction by passing other kinds of legislation. For instance, doing away with the taking of statements from children altogether who are age 13 and under, no waivers under any circumstances, which is wonderful, especially if you were to extend it to youth under 18. So we're behind in the sense that there are a number of jurisdictions that are really moving aggressively and boldly to do something about it. We're not
and it's doing well. That's what's important for us to learn from.
Yes. Yes. You know, we're not behind in the sense that most jurisdictions are not doing it.
But this is
an issue that is being widely considered all over the country and has the support of a lot of people in law enforcement.
Do you know what the stat? We have a lot of listeners in Jersey and Connecticut and Pennsylvania. Where are they? Are you familiar with what's happening in those states?
I wish I was. I'm sorry, I'm not. I've been so laser focused on the.
We'll make it an effort to. We have some contacts in those states, and we'll find out and give an update. So who's sponsoring the bill? What is the status of the bill now, Assembly and Senate in Albany?
The bill in the Assembly is sponsored by Latoya Joyner from the Bronx. The bill is A-5891-B, and it has passed through committees So as I understand the legislative process, you know, it's just a matter of what happens if getting that to a floor vote before the end of this legislative session. In the Senate, it has made it through the, I believe, Rules Committee and is now pending before the Codes Committee. In the Senate, it is Bill S-2800B. It's sponsored by Jamal Bailey, also from the Bronx. And, you know, that's a little bit behind where it is in the Assembly, but, you know, but it's on the move. And one of the things that we're urging people to do, listeners here especially, is to reach out to their representatives and urge their representatives not only to support the bill and to vote in favor of it, but to sign on as co-sponsors. The more co-sponsors there are to a bill, the more momentum it gathers and the more likely it is to get the support necessary to get passed.
So my obligation is to make inquiry of my two representatives to find out where they stand on the bill and urge them to be sponsors. Have you been able to determine yet where the opposition is coming from, or DAs or correction or anyone, police department or Republican spokespeople?
I can't point to specific individual entities, this DA or this police department, but I have been in conversations, based on conversations that I've had with the legislators and legislators' staff members, it's clear that the resistance comes from law enforcement. And law enforcement has one legitimate concern. The legitimate concern is that if this bill was passed, the likelihood is that there are fewer youth that would waive their right to remain silent and that would make a confession, and thereby making the job of law enforcement that much easier if they have a confession. But here's the thing. You know, while that might be a legitimate concern, you're talking about balancing, weighing the interest in getting a conviction at the expense of rendering meaningless a United States and state constitutional right. If you balance those two things, in my opinion and the opinion of many, it's a no-brainer. The Constitution wins out. And the fact of the matter is, even the United States Supreme Court, you know, while not in reference to this specific kind of piece of legislation, the United States Supreme Court has regularly, in decisions that it's rendered, said that, look, protecting a constitutional right is more important than, you know, simply getting to the bottom of the case. That's why we have suppression hearings. That's, you know, that's why we have the right to remain silent. That's why there's rules about whether they can search and seize you, you know, that go beyond whether or not, in fact, you had any illegal property on you, but whether there's legitimate suspicion to interfere with you and stop you and seize you and question you. So that's the legitimate concern, but the legitimate concern, as far as I'm concerned, pales when compared to the constitutional right, the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. You know, and you started out by asking that, talked about the, you know, the Central Park exonerated five, and that's obviously one of the other great, great disturbances or troubling factors here, that, you know, that youth render false confessions, make false confessions at a higher rate than adults do. And we all know there's an enormous amount of publicity from the Innocence Project in New York and Innocence Projects all over the country. We know the disturbing frequency of false confessions. People have seen the miniseries, but the program Making a Murderer that came out a number of years ago, and the questioning of a young man, Brendan Dassey, in Minnesota, who you could see how he was just led down the garden path by the police to say what it is that they wanted him to say. Basically, he was just, it's as if he said to me, tell me what you want me to say, yeah, and I will say it.
Well, Marty, you know,
long
ago, before there were videotapes, there was a boy named George Whitmore. He was, I don't know if he was a minor, I don't remember his exact age, but he's why we don't have the death penalty in New York, because they were so determined to get a confession on a crime that had swept through the city, that his lawyer said, in retrospect, he would have confessed to the murder of Lincoln and the crucifixion of Jesus if they kept going.
Yeah.
And he was innocent, and they had two people simultaneously because they were so determined to get a conviction, and they forced a confession out of this boy, George Whitmore, who, do you remember the case? It's why New York doesn't have death penalty.
Yeah, but you know, you make an excellent point, which is that the way the law stands right now, right, there is an incentive to get a confession so that you can get a conviction. And while, of course, all well-meaning law enforcement people don't want to convict the wrong person, there nevertheless is a bit of a conflict of interest that's presented there because the goal is to get a confession. The goal is to get a conviction. And if you get a confession, then that's likely to lead to a conviction. And that's the end of the case. The fact of the matter is every single time that that's done, not only is that a tremendous miscarriage of justice for the individual from whom that false confession has been extracted, but it's a miscarriage of justice for the entire community. Because number one, the Constitution has not been adequately defended. But number two, that means that the person that really did it is still out there and not being looked for anymore because the investigation is over, because they've gotten a confession from the person that they targeted, you know, as their primary suspect. So the community and the community's interest is put at risk. The United States, quite frankly, is way behind, you know, forget New York State, the United States in general is behind most of the Western world in terms of how this interrogation process is done. There are laws in Canada and Great Britain and elsewhere in Europe that are that regulate interrogations and make sure that interrogations are investigative procedures, not procedures that are all about making sure that the suspect confesses, but that are truly about simply gathering information and doing it in a way that is reliable.
You know, a few weeks ago, our guest on this program was Selwyn Rabb, who, when he was a reporter for the World Telegram, was covering the George Whitmore case back in 64, who had confessed, and the DA said he knew things that only the person who committed the crime would have known. And what Selwyn found out is that the crime took place on the day Martin Luther King made his I Had a Dream speech. So everybody knew where they were at that time. Yeah. And he found out that there were people in a hotel in Wildwood, New Jersey, saying that George Whitmore sat there and watched the speech with them. And the DAs knew this and held on to it because the pressure from City Hall was so great to solve the crime that they wouldn't let him go until they found the real person who had committed the crime. So they had two people at the same time. It's, you know, there's another part of this that really talked about, and it almost sounds conspiratorial, but I've gone a couple of times to American Correctional Association conventions, and there's always a field house in which enormous amount of money is exchanged, where people are selling corporations are selling barbed wire and food and cigarettes and inflammable blankets. And I suddenly realized that they have a great investment. Corporations have a great investment in keeping the prison populations up. In fact, they were behind the Rockefeller drug law because they were losing money when the military bases were closing. Now, it sounds so conspiratorial, but it was really a very planned process by a lot of companies, architects and construction companies that wanted to build prisons. And that now there's a knee-jerk reaction every time there's a bill that suggests that there might be less people being incarcerated, and they give the money and the support and the backing to the law enforcement agencies that and the unions, COBA and whatnot.
That in New York State, when there have been efforts to close correctional facilities upstate and youth detention facilities, youth placement facilities, you know, upstate. We know that there's been resistance, sure, from some well-intentioned, citizens who are concerned and think that there is a need. But we know that a lot of the resistance also comes from the unions that represent the people that work at those facilities, who are not responding because they necessarily can demonstrate that there's a need for the facility to continue to exist, but because it's a means of employment, and they don't want to lose the employment. And the communities where those facilities are don't want the people that work there to lose their employment, because then that's people, that won't be coming into the stores and shops and paying groceries and things.
The challenge there, of course, is to find alternate jobs. And Cynthia Nixon, of all people, when she campaigned, talked about windmill economy going into those towns, but that would not – the power of the unions would be sacrificed there. So it's a very complex social issue. Let's get on to the subject of what former Commissioner Schiraldi talked about, and that is the trial of children as adults. Sometimes the crime is so horrendous and gets so much publicity that there is an insistence that they be tried as an adult. But they're still children. And it's a very emotional issue because the crime is spelt out and it's gory and it's horrible, but the perpetrator is still a child. Yep. What's the measuring point? What's the cutoff place of when they're not?
I think that co-authored that. I believe that the timing of that was very much in response to, this attempt on the part of the governor and some others in city and state politics to roll back some of the justice reforms that have been put in place over the last number of years, especially the raise the age rules that were legislation that was passed several years ago that are in place right now. And look, the legislature made a judgment a few years ago, and I hasten to add, our state legislature was one of only two states. Our state was one of only two states to continue to try all youth once they turned 16 as adults. Only New York State and North Carolina were doing that up until a few years ago. So we were way behind the effort and the movement towards considering treating kids 16, 17, 18, and in some states even older, more like the juveniles and the youth that they are than treating them as adults. And the state legislature, took a big step in the right direction, not as big a step as they should have, as far as I'm concerned, and others as well, but they took a big step in the right direction, and they said, look, we're going to open the door for the 16 and 17-year-olds to be prosecuted as juveniles, as youth, because we know developmentally that they are much more like kids and children than they are like adults. We know that based on all this social science research that you really don't come into adulthood until your early or mid-20s. We know that there's still a lot of emotional, cognitive, neurological formation taking place, and that there are still severe limitations on the abilities to avoid on having exercise control, on what we generally refer to as executive functioning. So the legislature said, recognizing that they are not as responsible as adults are for their actions, we're going to create an opportunity and an opening for these youth to be treated like juveniles. And what they said essentially was, and, again, I'm oversimplifying a little bit, they said 16 and 17-year-olds charged with misdemeanors, except for some DMV cases, those cases are all family court cases now. We're no longer charging 16 or 17-year-olds charged with misdemeanors as adults. 16 and 17-year-olds charged with felonies, all those cases begin in the adult system, but there is a mechanism now, a much more sophisticated mechanism than there ever was. Well, actually, for 16 and 17-year-olds, there was no mechanism. previously. But there is now a mechanism to have those cases sent to family court. And there are several steps to that. I'm not going to get into the weeds on that right now, because I don't want to bore people, and there's a lot of evidence.
But, there is an answer to all this. I remember long ago, before I was even deeply into all of this, confronting a Bronx DA named Burton Roberts, who terrified the territory. Nobody knows who he is anymore. And he was making a claim about that. And I asked him if he had teenagers. And I said, do you discipline them? Are they adults? You know, if you talk to them, the prosecutors, about their own children, they're very aware of the fact. They know the fact that they may be 6 foot two, but still 15 or 17 or 18, and are not formally, are not fully responsible, or not fully developed to make sensible choices in their life, which is why they instruct the kids when they go out, don't drink, if make sure there's a driver that's sober, you know, all those things. Sometimes very practical aspects can at least be introduced to the Philistines and the criminal justice system. That's my thinking on it.
On a very personal level, right, I'm always fascinated at the disconnect. I mean, whether or not you're a parent and have yet had an adolescent youth, even if you're not a parent, the fact that you're alive and you're 21 or older means you've been an adolescent. And you know what being an
of
adolescent
course.
Is like. All
yes. Interesting. Weren't you know, we horrible when we were 16 and 17?
Yes. I venture to say there is no one listening to this broadcast, or quite frankly, very, very few people out there at all, who, if they looked back honestly at their history, even if they never got in trouble with the law, you know, could say, I never even broke a law. We all broke the law at one point or another. Some of us were fortunate enough that it never brought us into contact with the justice system, and we moved on, we grew up, and we became responsible, you know, members of society.
Marty,
even
if you get outside of the law, if I recall at 15, 16, 18, things that had nothing to do with crime or the legal system, how silly we could be, how miscalculated we were in assessing things that were going on around us. You know, at the Fortune Society, I've met over the hundreds and hundreds of teenagers, boys that are 6 foot three and intimidating. And when you talk to them, you say, oh my God, he's just a kid, unformulated, doubtful about so many things. It's the reality of childhood, and that the legal system tries to make adults out of them because it becomes about punishment rather than dealing with the reality of what's at stake. Marty Fineman, let's just review the legislation before we lose you. S-2800 is the Senate bill. A-5891 is the Assembly bill. And we are urging Pete. I'm sorry?
S-2800B and yes. A-5891B. We have to...
We have to make sure we have, oh, I'm sorry, the letters are important too. S-2800B and A-5891B are the legislation. Yeah. But if you can't remember the numbers, if you don't have a pencil, when you're writing to your legislator, say that to protect children, that they deserve their Miranda rights, and that they should find the bill themselves that makes sure it happens. Martin Feldman, we should do this more often.
Consultation with an attorney.
Pardon me?
The interrogation bill that mandates consultation with an attorney.
Right. Thank you so much for joining us, for enlightening us, and for this exchange.
David,
appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate All right. It. We're going to have a little music. Thank you, Martin Fineman. We've got a little music. Richard Kiley and Gwen Verdon from the Broadway musical Redhead.
Look who's in love, we are, well, aren't we? Look who's happy and high. Will you look who's in our arms, no one but us. Who is tugging at my heart, Who is, you is, who was surprised? We were, well, weren't we? You look as tipsy as I. Hear me say, hey people, how blessed can I be? Look who's in love with me.
Look who's in love. We are, well, aren't we? Look who's up, happy and high. Will you look who's in our arms? No one but us. Who is tugging at my heart?
Who is?
You is. Who was surprised? We were, well, weren't we? Look as tipsy as I. Hear me say, hey people, how blessed can I be? Look who's in love.
Look who's in love.
Look who's in love with me.
Richard Kiley, and I love hearing Gwen Verdon. It brings back memories of a great artist on the stage in New York theater. Talking about all of this, the new corrections commissioner, Luis Medina, falling in line with the union, COBA, has asked city council for money so he could hire 2,000 more correction officers to offset the fact that they have an epidemic of absenteeism, nearly 30%. Of the correction officers are not showing up on a given day, which is creating a lot of the problems that exist. That's only part of the problem that exists on Rikers Island. They should, if they hire 2,000, they should be replacing the chronic absenteeism, but the union would never stand for that, and that's where the battle would be. I hope you're reading Grand Raymond's pieces in the Daily News about all these machinations on Rikers Island. But Medina's solutions is a capitulation to the union. Can you imagine me talking about capitulation to the unions? I'm so pro-union. But when it comes to the correction officers union, you know, it's funny, former commissioner Vinnie Schiraldi, who's a genuine reformer, was on Brian Lehr this week on WNYC, and one of the callers came in from a correction officer who took Schiraldi to task for having hired a formerly incarcerated person as a commissioner, Stanley Richards, who I know quite well, you've heard on this program, whose credentials are impeccable and his capacity to relate to the problems on Rikers Island, having been a resident there 30 years ago. He was a perfect choice, and that perhaps, and this I tried to phone in, but they didn't have time, but perhaps Kevin, the correction officer, should spend more time being concerned about his union head, which was indicted for messing with the pension fund of his fellow union members. No one needed to apologize for the appointment of Stanley Richards, who was a great consideration by Vinnie Schiraldi. We took a trip to Bennington College years ago, Joanne Page, CEO at Fortune, myself, and the cast of The Castle. And in the van, I've talked about this, were five teenagers who were in our alternative to incarceration program. They picked five of the kids who were doing so well. And one of the young men, name was Leviticus, we discovered had been lost in the juvenile system, had been there 5 years, lost, didn't even know what the allegations for him were. Lost in the system. Somebody found him and he came to Fortune. I went to court with him in the Bronx court where the case was originally signaled, and the judge immediately let him go. And he became part of our alternative to incarceration program to benefit from the educational opportunities and vocational opportunities. It was an eye opener to learn that they lost somebody in the system. He never, and you know, this last week I got a call from Rikers Island from a man who has been there since before the pandemic and hasn't been able to talk to anybody for 2.5 years. And I called a lawyer who got somebody at Legal Aid, and he's going into court next week. But he had been forgotten about for 2.5 years. He's not a kid. He's a man in his 30s. The system has some flaws, in case you haven't noticed. We have tickets for we're listener sponsored WBAI. Did you know? Had you heard that? The Joyce Theater this week. I think I'm going to try and go. This sounds interesting. The folks from the Joyce Theater said Michelle Marino Lehrman is not really known in the dance world, but they suspect that it's that what she's offering is going to be create some news. Here's what it says. Tap is dance and tap is percussion, but tap can also be a vessel for stories, as artists such as Gregory Hines and Savion Glover have shown. At the Joyce, Michela Marino Lehrman adds to the genre of dance storytelling with Once Upon a Time Called Now, which starts previews on Tuesday when we have tickets, a tale of self-discovery narrated by Anne DeVere Smith, set with the context of Mardi Gras celebrations. And the show features live jazz performed on stage by a band of eight, the hoofing of Lehrman and four members of her ensemble. So that's coming to the Joyce Theater. We have for $50 to WBAI, you can have a pair of tickets. This Tuesday night at 7:30, the opening, Michela Marino Lehrman. I'm going to check my schedule. That's my kind of thing. We have a pair for next Thursday and a matinee next Sunday at the Joyce. Those of you who have in the past gone to the Joyce, as one woman said, she had gone to the Joyce about six times to us. She said it never fails to be an experience of utter joy. That's because the people at the Joyce scan the world for the best dance companies, and they find the well-established Paul Taylor's company coming in a few weeks. But they also find the next wave. And I love the idea of jazz tap with storytelling and Anne DeVere Smith narrating it. So on your market, set, go. If $50 for a pair of tickets, email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Tuesday night, we have four pair for the opening, one pair for Thursday night, and one pair for next Sunday matinee. And you can do all of that when Johnny Mathis is making his encore performance with a song by Webster and Livingston called The Twelfth of Never. Johnny Mathis.
You ask how much I need you. Must I explain? I need you, oh my darling. Like roses need rain. You ask how long I'll love you. I'll tell you true, until the 12th of never, I'll still be loving. Until 12. of never.
Johnny Mathis, as he used to serenade us. Remember that scene in the diner when the boys were arguing, who would you rather make out to, the singing of Johnny Mathis or Frank Sinatra? Charming part of that movie. I have talked about the assault on matzahs by the modern companies. This committed agnostic always enjoyed his childhood Passover seders. I remember in the Four Questions, why is this night different from all other nights? And I used to say to my sister, it's the only time the whole family gets together, which wasn't exactly true, but that was me being a smartass. But I did love the story, and the matzahs were that the Jews had to get out of town fast. It's part of Jewish history. They had to get out of town fast, and the bread didn't have a chance to get completed. It was unleavened bread was the matzah. So when I started seeing egg and onion matzahs and whole wheat matzahs, I said, those are Jews are going to get caught. They're spending too much time with the bread. So I was online yesterday at the market, and they had a whole section of matzahs for the holidays. And there were egg and onion and whole wheat and spelt matzahs. And then I thought you couldn't top a spelt matzah, and there were chocolate matzahs. And I said to the man in front of me online, those Jews are in trouble. They may have some taste of Hershey, but the Pharaoh's going to catch them. What's with them? We have theater tickets for a new Broadway play. It's down the line a little bit, but you might want to get it on the ground floor. It's the author is Tracy Letts, and the name of the play is The Minutes. I'm going to get the exact information for you so that you have all the information. Don't go away. Stay right where you are. The Minutes is coming to Studio 54 on Broadway. Tracy Letts, of course, who won the Tony and Pulitzer and all those things years ago. This is a new play that was started. It was in production when the pandemic began and is now coming to Studio 54 on 54th Street. It has a great cast, Blair Brown, Tony Award winner Jesse Muller. Wasn't she the original in Waitress? Sally Murphy, Austin Pendleton, K. Todd Freeman, who was and what was the name of that play that I worked on? Phew. See what happens when you hit a certain age? I'll remember it. Anyway, Tracy Letts is the author of The Minutes. It's being directed by Anna Shapiro. It's about a town's proud history, the legend of a local hero, the coveted privilege of reserved parking. Nothing is sacred during the town council meeting. It's called The Minutes, and it's how a town is revealed. At a town meeting, the ethos of the town and the townspeople are there. We have tickets for The Minutes Tuesday, April 5th, Wednesday, April 6th, and Thursday, April 7th, a $60 gift to WBAI, and you get a pair of tickets if you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. Tracy Letts also starred, also is in this play, and he also starred on Broadway. I think it was opposite Kathleen Turner in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Or was that Bill? I can't remember. There were so many productions of Virginia Woolf. There was Bill Irwin may have been the one opposite Kathleen Turner. I'm not sure. I remember being in the lobby of Virginia Woolf at one of the revivals, and Edward walked in, Edward being the playwright, Edward Albee. And I was with a couple of friends, and I said, I don't know why I was in the lobby, because the play was going on. And I said, Edward, this is Joe, this is Sam. Sam and Joe, this is Edward. And Edward went in and they said, who's that guy? I said, he was the playwright. He's, have I ever told you that story? I may have, that Edward Albee once came with me to the Thursday night meeting at the Castle. And it was the night that a judge running for DA in New York was going to be the guest of the residence. And before the meeting, we had an informal rap session with her and about six or seven other guys to talk about some of the things that the DA might be facing. And Edward sat in on the meeting with us. And he said, can I ask a question? I said, of course you can. And he did. And she was very rude and dismissive of him. She didn't win the election, I may add. And Cyrus Vance beat her. And as we were leaving, she said, who's that old ex-con? What did he do? And I looked at her and I said, well, I know he won three Pulitzer Prizes. I don't know what else he did. And I had to explain to her that her dismissiveness and rudeness was to Edward Albee. Now, what has this all got to do? Oh, we have tickets for the minutes. April 5th, 6th, and 7th. And you can be among the cognoscenti to see it. And you can also listen to an return engagement by Dolores Gray, who's now going to sing a song from the movie It's Always Fair Weather, which he was in. And this is by Andre Previn and Comden and Green.
Joe,
I'm waiting and watching.
Hello, Max. Hello, Bob. Hello, Jasper.
I hope and I yearn.
Hello, Bill. Hello, Phil.
Just for his return. Thanks for the present of the silver blue mink. Thanks for the plane and the ice skating rink. Thanks for the yacht and for the solid gold sink. Thanks a lot, but no thanks. Thanks for the Scrabble set with platinum board. Thanks for the factory once known as Ford. Thank you for finding me the famous lost chord. Thanks a lot, but no thanks. For I am just a faithful lassie waiting for her faithful lad. And there's no gift, however classy, by which this lassie can. For the banks and for the Santa Fe line. Thanks for the darling uranium mine. But I'm a gal with only one valentine. Thanks a lot, but no thanks. Thanks for the champagne. And thanks for the state of Maine. And thanks for the autograph picture of John. A lot, but no thanks. Thanks for the cruise, and thanks for the oil wells that ooze, and thanks for that pair of Fred Astaire shoes. Thanks a lot, but no thanks. For I am just a faithful lassie waiting for her faithful. Lassie can be heard. Thanks for losing your mind. And thanks for Fort Knox sealed and signed. But I've got a guy who's Clifton Webb and Marlon Brando combined. Thanks thanks a lot, but no.
Dolores Gray could knock your eardrums out if you saw her in a Broadway theater. She never needed to be mic'd. Did you see the story this week about the Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks, who when last located was halfway up Donald Trump's tush? He revealed that Donnie kept calling him, telling him that to introduce or to carry on saying that the 2020 election was illegal. And Mo Brooks, the congressman, said, well, it wasn't, and I can't, and I don't know the route. And so he had to release himself from Donnie's tush to make a run for the Senate. And Donnie's now campaigning against him. He wants somebody else to be the candidate for senator in Alabama. I guess Jeff Sessions is no longer a factor. Remember when Jeff Sessions used to be a guest on this program? There he is now. What was your job? I was the Attorney General of the United Confederacy of America. Well, he left, and he occasionally does a drop in here. But I thought that was kind of interesting that Donald just turned his back on one of his loyal supporters because he wouldn't do anything unconstitutional, like say the election was illegal. I saw Matt Damon, the actor, and Jerry White this week on a television interview. They've written a book called The Worth of Water about the water, about, you know, we take it pretty much, take it for granted. You put the water on. And when the scandal happened in Flint, it was a real shanda around the country that people in this country were being affected by impure water as a result of some political machinations that were happening in that state at the time. And but they've told us, and they showed film clips of the nobility and the drama of people getting water in unlikely places in Central America and Western Africa. It makes you, it's rather humbling to realize how we take for granted something like water. We are the privileged people, and there's nothing wrong with being privileged and having access to water. What it should inspire us to make sure, rather than being embarrassed or apologetic about being privileged with access to water, to help and find out how the rest of the world that doesn't have water, that's clean and life-saving, can have it also. That's instead of spending so much time with allegations about shame because you have, let's make sure that the others have, which is what the extraordinary Meredith Scott has been doing. She had a divorce from her husband, Mr. Barzos, who ran a little shop called the Amazon. I think she got half the money, and I think she's shaming the billionaire club. She's given away money to 1,257 groups, Habitat for Humanity, the Ailey Dance Company, Planned Parenthood got $250 million. They needed it this time because of what's happening in Texas and Mississippi, denying women the opportunities to make it, to be, talk about having the right to make a decision about your own body. The Fortune Society benefited from her generosity. It's life changer for the people that come to Fortune. What her generosity to us, to the Fortune Society, extraordinary. Fountain House, food banks, YWCAs, Broward College in Florida, $12 billion she has given away. Somebody said she'll be broke. Listen, she got about $40 billion from him. If she only had $1 billion left, you think she could scrape by? Isn't that interesting that somebody thinks that if you have $40 billion and you've given away $12 billion, that you're broke as a result? Extraordinary. Let me tell you about tickets that we have. Last week, our guest was the very interesting Tony Valdovinos, who was a dreamer, and he was denied going into the service after 9/11. He wanted to, he was a good American, found out he wasn't a citizen, came here when he was two with his parents from Mexico, And he became an organizer of dreamers and of people who've come to this country for the American dream. And some people have written a musical about him. It's called Americano. Preview start this week at the New World Stages on West 50th. We still have some tickets for this week and then the following week. This week we have a couple of pair of tickets for Thursday night, a couple of pair for Saturday night and Sunday night, and then the whole following week of April 4th. But this week, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday, tickets to see Americano, $50 per pair. If you email me at 212-209-2950. No, that's, what am I giving? You email me at, I'm giving a phone number, emailing me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. What was the number I just gave you? Was that a BAI number from years ago? Boy, talk about the mind and how it travels. Email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. All the tickets for American Buffalo and Cold Country have gone. We do have a couple of pair left at the Joyce Theater this Tuesday night to see Michelle Marino Lehman. I think that sounds very exciting. I hope you'll have a sense of adventure and get in on the ground floor of that. Do we have time for Martha Davis and Spouse to do a, by the way, On the Count is on deck. They're back with us this week. I think we have time for Martha Davis and Spouse for one more number.
No, it's 55. Time for Carly.
Oh, all right. Well, but Martha, I apologize. We didn't get to you. Carly Simon will say goodbye in her inimitable fashion. And you all can email if you want to see Americano or go to the Joyce Theater. dprfortune@hotmail.com.
Every time we say goodbye, I die a little. Every time we say goodbye, I wonder why a little. Why the gods above me must be in the know, think so little of me. They allow you to go, and when you're near, there's such an air of spring about it. I can hear.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI in New York. Any Saturday with David Rothenberg came to you live over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio WBAI in New York. Coming up at 10 o'clock is On the Count. Please stay tuned.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI New York with a moment in women's history.
What I'm curious to see, do the Constitution of the United States mean anything?
Fannie Lou Hamer was one of the most influential and powerful voices of the civil and voting rights movements. Born in 1917, Hamer grew up in poverty in the Mississippi Delta region, picked cotton starting when she was 6 years old. She underwent involuntary sterilization in 61, a common practice at the time to reduce the black population. She didn't know she had the right to vote until 1962 at a SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee meeting, and then she became an organizer in voter registration drives.
We are a part of America because we didn't come here on our own. Our parents and our descendants was from Africa, and we didn't come on our own, but we do want to be treated as human beings. And I'm fighting for human right, not for equal right.
In 1963, Fannie Lou Hamer was arrested at a sit-in protesting whites-only seating at a bus station. There she was severely beaten, resulting in lifelong injuries. By 64, she helped organize Freedom Summer and took part in organizing the Freedom Democratic Party and fought to run for Congress, challenging the local Democratic Party's efforts to block black participation.
We knew from the beginning that we wouldn't be seated, but we wanted to explain our side Whereas in a state that 42% of the people can't register, they wasn't representing us. And I think somebody, it's time now for somebody to be in Congress that's going to represent the people of Mississippi. And we wasn't allowed to go inside, but that didn't stop the challenge.
By 1968, Hamer's vision for racial parity in delegations became a reality, and she was a member of Mississippi's first integrated delegation. And in 71, she helped found the National Women's Political Caucus. You can hear more from Fannie Lou Hamer and other trailblazers by becoming a WBAI buddy, a sustaining member, for $15 a month. That's only 50 cents a day, and you'll receive WBAI